Reds up, Sheffield down. I can still remember the date, though I don't remember much about the day. I expect I did all the usual things, got up, went to work, maybe I was on playground duty. I remember the rain because it stopped about half an hour before kick-off. Tuesday, May the 4th, 1982. I was 28 and had been waiting all my life for that night to arrive. The Reds needed just 1 point from the last game of the season, home to Grimsby, to clinch promotion to the second division. For a supporter of a famous team, Arsenal United, that probably wouldn't seem like something worth writing home about. But for us, it was the pinnacle, not matched since we'd won the cup before the war, the First World War. We'd a new chairman at the time. In many ways, he matched the club perfectly. He wasn't a wealthy man. In fact, he had a stall on the market selling tights and what his sign coyly proclaimed to be ladies' foundation garments. He was christened Leonard Norton, but was known throughout the town as Knickers Norton. In fact, that season he even had his own song. It usually came right after "Come on, you Reds, and there'll not be many going home," when a lone voice would strike up with the words, "Oh, Knicker, 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 Knicker Norton, Knicker, 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 Knicker Norton," and then the lads would start shouting, "Off, off, off." Lenny Norton had a saying, though, that, looking back, probably summed up everything: the club, the team, the town, and maybe us. It was the programme one Saturday in a very short column called "The Chairman Speaks." In this, Lenny declared that he wouldn't rest until the club of ours had reclaimed its rightful place, the second division. My dad had first taken me down to the ground when I was a lad. In fact, he didn't pay for me until I was 10. The bloke on the turnstile that worked at me dad's pit would say, "Right, squeeze through quick before it clicks," and then, fighting for breath, with my face buried in the front of my dad's gabardine, I'd stagger backwards through the narrow blackness to emerge in the cool air of the cop, where my dad would say, "You all right, Richard, love?" And unable to speak, I'd just nod. When I was 10, I think we were home to Workington. The inevitable finally happened. For some reason, we didn't beat the click and I got stuck. Me dad went mad. "What the bloody hell? Push, will they? Push!" Then the turnstile man said, "It's clicked. They'll not get through now. They're stuck." "I know I'm stuck. I'm not leet. Let us through, will ya?" "Sorry, pal. Can't do nowt once it's clicked." By now, there was a big queue, which in itself was an event. The bloke at the front shouted through to us, "They'll have to lift him." "I'll bloody lift thee in a minute if thou doesn't shut thy rattle." We finally got into the ground, where my dad sat me down on the top step of the terrace and started to waft my sweaty face with his cap. "You all right, Richard?" It was hard even to nod. "Stand clear." "Thou what?" "Man down here. Make way, make way, stretcher." It was Kenneth Brisby and his son, Harry. They were in the St John's and had their own dugout near the far corner flag, where they'd sit in full regalia every home match. They lived near us and were big with the primitive Methodists. My dad assured the disappointed Brisby that I was all right, and we trudged down to our usual perch near the front. We stood freezing as the Reds, after taking an early lead, slumped to another defeat. Looking back, I think that's when my dad's faith started to ebb away. I don't know if it was the result or the knowledge that from now on he'd have to pay for me as well. But something died that day. As I got older, I could see the symptoms getting progressively worse. When I was 15, he stopped going mid-season after a match against Brighton that we'd won 4-1. I couldn't understand it. "Look, we're fifth now, 2 games in hand. If we keep going like this, we'll get into the second, and then it'll be the first." My dad just laughed, and then he leaned forward and, using the same tone he adopted when outlining his conspiracy theory about the pit manager, the parson, and Sir Stafford Cripps, said, "Listen, son, they'll never be in the first. And does thou know why they'll never be in the first?" "Why, Dad?" because they don't want it, that's why. They might get into the second, I grant you that, but as far as it goes, they'll see it's the directors, they're money men. They don't want the first division wages. Why does they think we always sell our best players? As the years went by, he hardly ever went near the ground. I persuaded him occasionally, usually around Christmas, but every time he showed up, they lost, much to his delight. And as we walked back to the bus station, he'd smile a grim smile and say, "Well, what did I tell thee? They don't want it. They don't want it." So that night, May the 4th, meant everything. We had a great year, never out of the top six, quarter-finals of both cups, and knocked out three first-division teams on the way. As the season went by, the crowd started to get bigger. The usual faithful 5,000 grew to 6, 7, 10,000. When spring came and we were still up there, it became 13, 14, even 15,000. Whole sections of the ground that I'd only ever seen as empty, concrete steps with the occasional bit of rose bay willow herb started to fill with people. Men brought their sons, whole families turned up, women as well, much to me dad's disgust. Now, what the hell does thou want woman at a football match, eh? And my mother would smile and say, "I think it's a good idea, letting women join in." To which my dad would just say, "Ah, see what I mean? Road to nowhere, women," and stomp off to the cross keys. I got to the ground an hour before the kick-off, a previously unheard-of necessity, having endured the long winter campaign with the fog on the M62, snow at Carlisle and the pies in Rotherham. I wasn't going to lose my usual position on the East Terrace to some part-timers who'd just turned up for the glory. For some reason, it seemed vital to stand in exactly the same spot each week. It was towards the back, almost at the halfway line and exactly in line with the F on the advertising hoarding on the other side of that read Norton's For Your Foundations. There were three or four of us always stood there. We'd been at school together. We'd often have a pint each after the match, just mates really, and then there were the others, familiar faces of men without names. We gave them names, being clever college lads and making our way in the teaching profession. There was Big Jock, who strangely enough was Scottish and 6'4". His thing was to arrive at 3:01 and stand right in front of a tiny old man called the Weasel. Then there was Robbie Rattle. He was, I suppose, a couple of steps short of a full terrace, and unusually even for the club, still owned and used a rattle. These had gone out in the 1960s. I had one for about three matches till my dad got fed up with it. He'd been on nights all week, and I think it was the last straw when, celebrating a last-minute equaliser, I whizzed my rattle round in front of his face. I can still remember him grabbing it from my hand and flinging it high into the floodlit night. It sailed over the back of the cop and dropped into some nettles by the far wall. At full time, I was all for scrambling down the back of the cop to recover it, but he wouldn't let me. Then on the way home, as I fought back hot tears, he softened a bit and said, "Give over, will thou? I'll get thee another, but don't say nowt to thy mum." So there we were, May the 4th, 1982, me, the lads, Big Jock, the Weasel, Robbie Rattle, and all the other faces, the man in the trilby that looked like Maigret, the fat kid from the Building Society, and the three old men who we called the Wise Monkeys draped over the barrier next to us, visions in Harris Tweed. Hundreds of faces, thousands of faces, the whole town, 21,000 people packed onto the terraces, old-timers saying to each other, "Aye, but it'll not last, thou knows. Thy don't want it." First-timers saying, "Who's that playing at number 9? And me drinking it all in like the best pint of beer I'd had in my whole life. Two things almost spoilt the evening. One was when Grimsby, against the run of play, and in the opinion of 21,000 people, miles offside, took an early lead. There was an appalled silence as their players rolled about in front of our cop until one of the Wise Monkeys said quietly, "Tell thee they didn't want it." The moment when they scored was almost, but not quite, as bad as when the Reds had run out into a storm of applause that came rolling down the terraces in waves and suddenly turned to embarrassed laughter as we saw the lads had been given some kind of special kit to wear for the big match. It had little white flashes on the shoulders that from a distance made them look like they were wearing brassieres. It all came right in the second half, two goals from the Reds, and then the worst 10 minutes of my life as Grimsby pressed forward time after time. But that moment, when the referee finally blew for full time, was the best moment of my life. I'd never heard a noise like it. Robbie Rattle's arm was just a blur. One of the wise monkeys flung his cap high into the night, and Big Jock turned round and lifted the weasel off the ground. Old Weasel protested, but only a bit. "I've got angina, put me down." And me, I was crying. Later I walked into the tap room to find my dad, who, true to form, had refused my invitation to the match. "We've done it, Dad. 2-1. We're up. Promoted." "It'll not last. They never wanted it" speech, but tonight was different. He looked at me, quietly, like he used to do when I was a little kid, out of breath from the turnstiles, and said, "I'm right glad for thee, Richard, love. Right glad. But you see, Sheffield's gone down." "What are you on about, Dad? They weren't playing, were they? The HMS Sheffield. They bloody sunk it." "What?" 21 dead, young lads like thee." And I didn't know what to say. Me and the old man had already clashed over the Falklands, like we did over most things by then. He was all for it. I had my usual wishy-washy doubts. I let him buy me a drink and we sat down together, neither of us speaking. Later, after I'd dropped me dad off, I knew why I'd cried at the match. I'd cried for a picture in my head, me as a little boy, and my dad holding hands as we walked up the hill all those winters ago, and me, 8 or 9 years old, looking back through the steady moving tide of coats and caps, gazing up at the big black sky and the red roofs stand shining like a dream. But most of all, I've been crying for me and my dad. We were never so close again as we were on those cold Saturdays when we'd won nothing. But anything was possible, so long as you believed.